Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for April the 23rd, 2018. This is David Corey, along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, good evening, David, and good evening, everyone out there. We have several segments tonight with news about developments in the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, including comments from the acting VA Secretary, Robert Wilkie, a story on opioid abuse, developments in the transition assistance program to help military members who are leaving active duty and returning to civilian life, the Veterans Choice Program, and much more. So stay tuned for another fast hour of news and information. But first, I'll remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And I want to remind our veterans that this is the Veterans News Hour. This is your hour. This is your time to call us and to express whatever opinions you have about the VA, about how they might be handling your particular claim, or any other particular item that's on your mind. Call us. Again, call us at 1-888-627-6008. Over to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. Now, as just about everyone knows, President Trump fired Dr. David Shulkin as the VA secretary a few weeks ago. President Trump also nominated White House physician Dr. Ronnie Jackson as the new VA secretary. But until Congress acts on that nomination, the acting secretary is Robert Wilkie. In addition to being the acting VA secretary, Robert Wilkie is the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. That means Mr. Wilkie is the principal advisor to the Secretary and Deputy Secretary of Defense for total force management as it relates to readiness, National Guard and Reserve matters, health affairs, training, personnel requirements, and personnel management, including equal opportunity, morale, welfare, recreation, and the quality of life for military families. So a lot of issues you can see would also apply to veterans. He's the son of an Army artillery commander. Robert Wilkie spent his youth at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He has more than 20 years of experience at the national and international level. During the George W. Bush administration, Mr. Wilkie served both Robert Gates and Donald Rumsfeld as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 2005 to 2009 and was the youngest senior leader in the department. Prior to his first Pentagon tour, he was the Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs and a Senior Director of the National Security Council under Dr. Condoleezza Rice. Mr. Wilkie also has extensive experience in the United States Congress, including recent service as senior advisor to Senator Tom Tillis, as well as being counsel and advisor on international security affairs to the Majority Leader of the United States Senate, the Honorable Trent Lott. Mr. Wilkie is also a reserve officer in the United States Air Force Reserve, assigned to the Office of the Chief of Staff. Prior to joining the Air Force, he served in the United States Navy Reserve with the Joint Forces Intelligence Command, the Naval Special Warfare Group 2, and the Office of Naval Intelligence. Mr. Wilkie holds an honors degree from Wake Forest University, a Juris Doctor from Loyola University College of Law in New Orleans, a Master's of Law in International and Comparative Law from Georgetown University, and a Master's in Strategic Studies from the United States Army War College. And we thought it would be helpful to hear what Mr. Wilkie said recently in a recorded message to VA employees upon him taking office as the acting secretary. So, Doug, if you'll please roll the first tape for this evening.
Good day, everyone. My name is Robert Wilkie. I'm deeply grateful to President Trump for the opportunity to serve with you and for America's veterans. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the end of the war to end all wars. 100 years ago, my great-grandfather left the comfort of teaching law at Ole Miss to join the 320th Field Artillery Regiment of the 82nd Infantry Division, assembling at Camp Gordon, Georgia. Across the cantonment from his regiment was an infantry outfit whose muster roll included a reluctant scratch farmer from Pall Mall, Tennessee, by way of Buncombe County, North Carolina, by the name of Alvin York. In another part of the country was my wife's grandfather, who had probably never ventured beyond three or four counties in North and South Carolina, but by the time he was 18, he was marching up the Champs-Élysées into the terrible battle of the Meuse-Argonne. Captain A.D. Somerville, Sergeant Alvin York, and Private Onslow Bullard, ordinary Americans called upon to do extraordinary things. It is their descendants whom we are honored to serve, millions of ordinary Americans who have answered a special call for us and for the world. At my Pentagon swearing-in, I was proud when the officiating officer noted that I had been born in khaki diapers. I've been privileged to see this military life from many angles, as a dependent, as the son of a gravely wounded combat soldier, as an officer in two services, the Navy and the Air Force, and as a senior leader in the Pentagon. Being with you today is the culmination of a lifetime of watching those who have borne the battle. I do not know how long I will be privileged to serve as the acting secretary, but let me tell you a little bit about my philosophy. Customer service is the key, but customer service not necessarily in the way you might think. Customer service must start with each other, not talking at each other, but with each other across all office barriers and across all compartments. If we don't listen to each other, we won't be able to listen to our veterans and their families. And we must have a bottom-up organization. The energy must flow from you who are closest to those we are sworn to serve. It is from you that the ideas we carry to the Congress, the VSOs, and to America's veterans will come. Anyone who sits in this chair and tells you he has all the answers is in the wrong business. This is a noble calling. We have a solemn responsibility to veterans, not just today, but in the months and years to come, to set the standard for the millions coming into our VA and for the millions who will join the ranks down the years. This is our important and non-negotiable mission. The President and the Congress support us, and I'm honored to help lead this organization. I look forward to meeting as many of you as possible in the coming days. I value your insights and your thoughts as we improve our department for the challenges in the years ahead. Thank you, and God bless.
Well, we thank the VA for that that audio tape from Mr. Wilkie, the acting VA secretary. Very informative. Interesting to hear his thoughts as he holds that position. Richard, what do you think? What can you tell us about the nomination of Dr. Jackson?
Well, As you pointed out, I think, and we may have pointed out on our last show, the problem with Dr. Jackson is that he has no administrative experience. I believe some of the research I found, the most he has ever supervised is about 40 to 45 staff members. And now he's expected to supervise an agency or a department that has approximately 377,000 members and employees. It's a dubious task for anybody, but for someone with no administrative experience, I don't know. Maybe he can put together a good staff. You know, Mr. Wilkie and others to assist him, but just on the surface, it appears that he lacks a lot of the qualifications necessary to lead such a arduous department, such as Department of Veteran Affairs. And I know we've had some guests on the show who I've subsequently talked to about this, and they're all expressing some discontent for essentially the same reasons. But we'll see. I mean, he still has to be confirmed, and we'll see what happens. Obviously, he's a good doctor. He's served for three presidents now, Bush, Obama, and Trump. So that you can't say anything about those qualifications. it's the other that I'm very, very concerned about for the obvious reasons. What do you think, David?
No, I share those same concerns. The VA is a huge department. It's the second largest federal government agency behind the Department of Defense. A lot of people, a lot of resources, and a lot of so-called moving parts. And
you know, David, I thought we had kind of solved some of those problems when Shulkin was nominated and took over, because now, here was a doctor, a renowned physician in his own right, who would run a couple of hospitals in New Jersey. So I'm very familiar with one of those hospitals, having lived in New Jersey. So I really thought maybe they got it right, but, you know, he didn't make it either.
Well, I don't think Dr. Shulkin was given enough time. He was in office as the VA secretary for 14 months. And I realized before that, in the Obama administration, he had served for maybe about a year and a half as the head of the Veterans Health Administration, which is a major component of the entire VA. But I don't think he had enough time at all to implement his ideas. And I think he would have been, you know, kind of a perfect candidate to continue to do that, perfect person to do that. You know, perhaps no one is perfect, but as far as his qualifications, like you said, he was a lot of expertise in hospital administration, as well as being a physician himself. But in any way, that's unfortunately history now, and we look ahead. What can you tell us about Dr. Jackson's Senate confirmation?
Let me ask you this, David, because you know you've been involved with the VA for a long time, both as a veteran and after you're out of the service. Why haven't they ever thought about getting someone who, I'm thinking lawyer only, because somebody who's been involved with litigation, involved with mediation and arbitration, you know, I mean, we're so focused on the hospital side that we continue to overlook the compensation side, which continues to be a huge problem for the VA and for 470-some-odd thousand veterans who are waiting for their appeals to be heard.
Well, I think
historically,
what they need,
have we had different people in that position who had more of that background?
We've had quite a varied group that have served as the VA secretary. We had before Robert McDonald, who was a veteran himself, had there had been Dr. Shinseki, who had been 4-star Army general, and a variety of other backgrounds, prior VA secretaries. But also keep in mind that under the VA secretary, you have the Veterans Benefit Administration, which, as the name suggests, was more concerned about the veteran issues that you were just talking about, as opposed to the veteran health side. Both sides are obviously very important to veterans and veterans' families, but we'll have to see. It's I think what's been proven in the past is that with such a wide variety of backgrounds among the VA secretaries, that no one particular background has had the magic solutions. So that obviously isn't going to be the end of the analysis. It's going to be, can that particular individual help lead that whole team, that large team in the VA, and have a good relationship with Congress, which is what they need. So, any event, we probably need to move on to our next segment. But beforehand, what can you tell us about the confirmation hearing for Dr. Jackson?
Certainly. We certainly do hope that if and when Dr. Jackson is confirmed, that he is able to hit the ground running. However, given, as I previously said, given his lack of experience running an organization the size of the VA, again, 377,000 staff members, I have to wonder if he will quickly become captive to the power of the VA bureaucracy, which is often very slow to change. Dr. Jackson's Senate confirmation hearing is set for this Wednesday, April 25th, at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The hearing should be broadcast through the committee website, which is veterans.senate.gov. Again, that's veterans.senate.gov. Okay, let's move on to our second segment tonight, dealing with an important health issue affecting not only veterans, but many Americans. According to the National Safety Council, every day 60 Americans die from opioid pain medication. That's 22,000 people every year. That number includes all Americans, not just military veterans, but military veterans are included in that number. This past week, on April 17, 2018, VA Acting Secretary Robbie Wilkie visited the National Safety Council prescribed to death opioid memorial and recorded this message. Doug, please roll take number two.
Hi, I'm Robert Wilkie. I'm visiting the National Safety Council's Prescribed to Death Opioid Memorial. The memorial is currently located here at the White House. It's part of President Trump's initiative to stop opioid abuse and reduce drug supply and demand. Inside, 22,000 faces are engraved on small white pills. Each symbolizes the tragic story of an American lost to prescription opioid overdose. Some are veterans. Veterans who defended this nation with courage and honor. Many veterans have survived serious battlefield wounds, and some endure pain for months, for years, and even for the rest of their lives. In fact, nearly 60% who served in the Middle East and more than 50% of older veterans live with some form of chronic pain. And we have to provide them and all Americans safe, effective pain management that lets them live fulfilling lives. For more than a decade now, the Department of Veterans Affairs has been doing just that. In just the last 4 years, we've reduced opioid use by over 41% among veterans we serve. We've established evidence-based collaborative approaches, ways to manage pain more safely and effectively, while minimizing reliance on opioids. We're improving the effectiveness of our pain management teams and expanding treatment options at every facility. We're coordinating with community care providers to ensure prescriptions are managed as safely as possible. We've issued the life-saving drug Noxolene to over 100,000 veterans to help prevent tragedies. Our opioid therapy risk report provides detailed information on risk factors and helps clinicians design effective pain management and treatment plans. We're bringing the power of big data analytics to bear, as well as VA's stratification tool for opioid risk mitigation, STORM for short, that puts predictive analytics in the hands of providers. STORM estimates overdose or suicide risk among veterans using or considering opioid therapy, and it offers risk reduction interventions and non-opioid options. VA clinicians are giving extra attention to veterans at risk of tragic outcomes. Treating pain is complex, but as President Trump said, we can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. He's right, and the VA is helping lead the way. Thank you, and God bless all who have served.
According to the National Safety Council, opioids are being overprescribed, and it is not children reaching in medicine cabinets who have made drug poisoning the number one cause of unintentional death in the United States. Adults have been prescribed opioids by doctors and subsequently become addicted or moved from pills to heroin. Perhaps even more alarming, 70% of people who have abused prescription painkillers reported getting them from friends or relatives. Most people don't know that sharing opioids is a felony. People who take opioid painkillers for too long and in doses too large are more at risk of addiction and more likely to die of drug poisoning. The numbers are staggering. In a 2014 National Survey on Drug Use and Health Report, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says there are 4.3 million current non-medical users of painkillers. Nearly 2 million people have painkiller substance use disorders. According to Dr. Don Peter, National Safety Council medical advisor, painkillers don't kill pain, they kill people. People think opioids is the best way to treat pain, but the reality is Other non-addictive medicines are just as effective, including many over-the-counter drugs such as ibuprofen or naproxen. Opioid abuse is a major problem across America, including among veterans with chronic or severe pain. It's an issue that will require ongoing attention by healthcare providers and the VA. And let me share a story of a recent meeting I had with one of my clients. This young man, in his mid to late 30s, was a prison guard at one of the Florida federal penitentiaries. We're in North Florida. He had worked there for 16 years. He had a service-connected disability for his knee, and he was being treated by the VA for that knee. He had to have some treatment done on it, and after the treatment, the VA prescribed him opioids for the pain. Well, he abused the medication that was being prescribed to him by the VA. But he never would have gotten on that medication in the first place, but for the fact that the VA prescribed it to him. Fast forward, he lost his job as a result of the opioid. He became addicted to it. He lost his job after 16 years with the federal penitentiary. He was paying child support to his ex-wife, and a sum of about $800 a month. He had no problem paying that. He was paying a mortgage. He had no problem paying that. He was currently married at the time when he lost his job, and he was taking care of them. Subsequent to that, he ended up getting divorced from his second wife. He ended up continuing with the opioids. His life just continued to spiral downward. He owed the second ex-wife $1,200 in child support. So he had $800 for one wife, $1,200 for the other wife. And now the family courts were looking for him, and he then got incarcerated a few times on bench warrants for failure to pay child support. When I saw him the other day, his first ex-wife was with him, and she has been an incredible source of strength for him. He's off the opioids. He's in recovery. He's doing whatever he can. He still has these enormous child support obligations, which he's going to have to take care of in family court. But prior to him coming to my office, he had been living in his car in the driveway of his first wife. So this was a veteran, an honorably discharged veteran who was working in the federal penitentiary of the United States. Had worked his way up within that prison system. He was a supervisor. Lost that job. Lost the marriages. Basically ends up homeless. And in addition to that, he turned to heroin. And he was arrested and charged with possession of heroin about 6-8 months ago. So if you do the but-for test, as we lawyers like to do, but for the VA prescribing that medication for the opioid, for the painkiller, this veteran may not, I can't say for sure, but he may not have spiraled downward to the point where now he's looking essentially at jail. So that's a real-life experience of a veteran who has suffered because of the opioid crisis.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that story, Richard. I think that also reinforces the point that the earlier statistic that you read, how 60 Americans die from opioid pain medications every day, and that's 22,000 people that die every year. That includes all Americans, not just veterans. But the story you just described shows that the harm from opioid overprescription, the addiction, and everything that can follow from that can seriously harm a person's life, harm their family, even if it doesn't result in an overdose death. Certainly, lives are being destroyed. So it's a really important issue. We'll continue to follow it. Hopefully, our listeners found the report from VA Acting Secretary Robert Wilkie about the VA initiative. Certainly the VA has received a lot of well-deserved criticism for its prescription, over-prescription of medications, but at least they're recognizing it's a problem and hopefully are working in the right direction. So,
David, on that note, I mean, one of the things, and we've talked about this before, one of the things that I consistently see, you know, we represent a lot of veterans who are struggling with PTSD. And the story that I've heard over the last 6 years, and I continue to hear, is the amount of prescriptions that they get prescribed for their PTSD. And what happens often is they'll have a psychologist or a psychiatrist that they're seeing for 6 to 8 months, and they've been prescribed a certain medication. They got that prescription, kind of it's working for that veteran at that point. Now, they had to tweak it along the way, but finally, whatever the medication might be, they've tweaked it so that the veteran's comfortable with it. And then all of a sudden, 6, 8 months down the road, he goes into the VA, and he's told that he has a new psychologist or a new psychiatrist. He meets with that new person, and one of the first things they do is, I want to take you off the medication that you were on, and now we're going to put you on something new. Time and time again, I hear this same scenario, and it's mind-boggling that that situation occurs. And these veterans that come into my office and tell me the story, they look dumbfounded. They don't know what to do because they're supposed to trust this person.
Right.
And, you know, and what it's horrific.
Yeah.
It makes my blood boil, to tell you the truth. It really does.
Yeah.
Because we shouldn't be doping these people up. And that's what we're doing. The VA is doping people up.
Right. Setting them up for all sorts of problems, as you've described. But, it's really important issue, not just for veterans, but for all Americans. It's an opioid crisis. It really is a crisis. You know, 22,000 people are dying from the overuse of that every year. It needs to get some attention. But, all right, well, let's go ahead and move on to our next segment. For those of you that may have just tuned in, I want to welcome you to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. Our call-in number, grab your pen and paper. We certainly invite your calls, share your comments, your questions, your insights. It's 1-888-627-6008. Again, our toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Now, in other VA news this week, we have a story of interest to those who will soon be leaving active duty and returning to civilian life. This report is from a VA news release from last Monday, April the 16th. As part of the VA's ongoing efforts to help service members navigate and understand VA's various benefits, the VA recently updated the VA's briefing portion of the Transition Assistance Program, or TAP, which is an interagency initiative with DOD. It was authorized as a voluntary program back in 1991 and then became mandatory in 2011 to help service members adjust to civilian life, which, Richard, you and I know, is for many veterans is really a big deal. Now, this new VA briefing is designed to be more collaborative, more stimulating, helping service members make informed decisions about their health care, their employment, their housing, and other benefits. According to Acting VA Secretary Wilkie, and I quote, each year thousands of military members leave the service and settle in communities around the nation with the goals of establishing comfortable homes, attaining quality education for themselves and their families, and finding rewarding employment opportunities. Coming from the Department of Defense, I understand the importance of this great program, and I believe these changes will strengthen it further and provide real-life relevance to those who have given a portion of their lives to serving our nation, unquote. Now, the program recognizes that no two transitions from active duty to civilian life are identically the same, so the program updates elements that are relevant to service members based on where they are in their career and their point in time in life. Keep in mind that some veterans may leave active duty in their early 20s, some may leave in their late 40s. So the redesign will encourage kind of a whole health support for service members and their families, to include information about veteran service organizations and allow time to identify local VSO, veteran service organization representatives. The updates, which were released this month, incorporated suggestions made by veterans, veteran service organizations, and post-9/11 veteran groups, including taking a more holistic view of a service member's new life, as well as the psychosocial aspects of the transition to civilian life. According to Margarita Devlin, the executive director of the VA Benefits Assistance Service, and I quote, in fiscal year 2017, VA provided more than 63,000 events to educate more than 500,000 transitioning service members and family members. VA consistently receives high evaluations from service members who attend these benefit briefings, and we have taken the next step by incorporating recommendations by other stakeholders to make the program even better. The VA will now work to fully incorporate the Transition Assistance Program, or TAP, objectives into the military, and as an added benefit, we'll be implementing a new post-transition veteran survey. If our listeners are interested in finding more about this updated curriculum, the website is benefits.va.gov/TAP, T-A-P. That's benefits.va.gov/TAP. Over to you, Richard.
Thank you, David. In other news from Washington, it was 4 years ago that the wait time scandal at the VA hospital in Phoenix came to light. The long wait times at Phoenix VA and at other department facilities nationwide led to long delays in veterans receiving care. A couple of weeks ago, the acting VA secretary called on Congress to pass legislation to continue to address the issue of veteran access to timely medical care. In an April 9, 2018 statement, acting VA Secretary Wilkie stated, and I quote, following that scandal, Congress passed the bipartisan VA choice legislation that allowed veterans to seek care in the private sector when faced with VA wait times of over 30 days or when veterans had to travel more than 40 miles to see a doctor. Funding for the choice program was set to expire last year, but Congress extended it twice while it worked on a bipartisan deal for the next generation of choice legislation that would give even better options for veterans to seek care in the community when the VA was unable to provide them the best standard of treatment. It's time to fix the choice program as well as the department's other non-VA care efforts once and for all by merging them into a single streamlined community care program that's easy to use for veterans and VA employees. America's veterans are looking to Congress and VA to come together now to provide them the best possible solutions for their care. Your VA will be working overtime to achieve the promise of leaving no veteran waiting for care. Right, end of quote. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. And in a related story, this past Monday, the VA issued a press release about actions that it will take to address challenges and issues identified by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, when it placed the VA on its so-called high-risk list. The move is designed to address lingering deficiencies in the VA's healthcare system, supposedly once and for all, but we'll see. Every 2 years, the GAO calls attention to agencies and program areas that are high-risk as a result of vulnerabilities and problems and in need of transformation. The VA is currently in the midst of a department-wide modernization that will hopefully build capacity for the long-term management of the identified high-risk activities and hopefully strengthen the VA's foundational business practices, according to the VA press release. Now, what are those five specific high-risk areas that the GAO identified? They included, going back to 2015, ambiguous policies and inconsistent processes. It included inadequate oversight and accountability, information technology challenges, inadequate training for VA employees, and unclear resource needs and allocation priorities. Now, the VA's press release last week indicated that the VA is working hard on each of those areas. As far as the ambiguity in policies and the red tape, the VA is saying, it says that it has eliminated outdated policy documents. They've purged over 235 expired directives, and 85% of all outdated manuals. As far as eliminating bureaucracy, the VA says they've reduced the central office staff positions by 10% and consolidated other functions in mental health, primary care, and geriatric areas. As far as strengthening internal oversight and accountability, the Veterans Health Administration established the Office of Integrity to consolidate its compliance, ethics, and oversight programs and took other steps to establish an internal audit function. As far as modernizing information technology, the VA says that their electronic health record, or EHR, modernization program will help enable a seamless care and full interoperability with the Department of Defense. We'll see how that works out. And then as far as clarifying resources and priorities, the VA established a centralized manpower management office to integrate staffing processes and to transform its financial management methods. Again, both areas, Richard, that you and I have talked about the VA in the past year, the fact that the VA is understaffed by tens of thousands of employees to meet their expected needs. And also they've had problems as far as financial management, some of the projects going over budget, those sorts of things. So a lot of areas, fortunately for the American public and for veterans, the GAO is exercising its oversight. Sometimes I wish Congress would pay more attention to what the GAO is doing. In any event, that's enough news from Washington, Richard. I understand you had the opportunity to pay a visit to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in North Carolina this past week. How'd your visit go? What'd you think of the base?
I sure did. My daughter, my three grandchildren, and my son-in-law. My son-in-law is a captain in the United States Air Force, and he flies F-15s. He currently is a trainer, trains new pilots. Matt's been in the service now for about 8 years. But what an experience. You know, I'm not sure, David, did not serve, but I really did not have any experience other than my father was in the United States Marines, and he was a drill sergeant. But by the time we came along, he was a civilian and only served for a few years. So the whole military experience was something that I didn't really have. And I've gotten a lot of respect ever since I started as a partner with you, David, and representing veterans. But I got a chance to kind of see firsthand. And what a thrill, I tell you. It was great. One night, we had dinner. It was a buffet dinner with the squadron. They were doing night flights out over the Atlantic Ocean. And just to see these young men and their wives and their children and the camaraderie that they had, the laughing. I mean, just, you know, the ambiance in the area where we were eating was super. And each one of these men, and there was one woman, were going out that night in a fighter jet. And, you know, we always assume that they're going to come back safely. But I was listening to some of the stories, and this one guy was telling me, this one pilot said, you know, I never tell my wife when things go wrong up there. And I asked him, I said, well, how often do they go wrong? He says, more often than you think. It really kind of hit home with me because, yes, they're training. They're not in combat. But they're still putting their life out there for us civilians. And I don't think I'll ever forget that. We hear every once in a while, a helicopter might go down. I think one went down to San Diego, the United States Marines. But four were killed there. But I think it's something that civilians have to realize that, you know, preparing for combat is an ongoing thing. Just like a sports person who has to practice his craft in football or basketball. And pilots have to go out there every single day and go up in the air and engage, and stuff happens. I walked away with a newfound respect for our military. And I had a lot of fun talking to you, David. I remember, I was sending you some pictures And you served there for 3.5 years, I believe, said, at Goldsboro,
right.
Seymour Johnson. And
yeah.
What we were having, why don't you tell us the story about President Bush? Because my daughter, son-in-law, and my grandson, we were having a picnic in the park there, and then you had made reference to, President Bush came to speak at that point. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, I when I was on active duty in the Air Force, I had quite a few active duty assignments, and probably my most favorite assignment was at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro. I was there from February of 1990 until June of 1993. 6 months after I arrived, Iraq invaded Kuwait, setting off the events, including Operation Desert Shield, Operation Desert Storm. And while I was at Seymour then in 1992, I went and served in Saudi Arabia for several months. But when the war itself, Operation Desert Storm, kicked off in January of 1991, our base, our deployed F-15Es, were actively involved from day one. And because our base was so involved, then President George H.W. Bush came and paid a visit to our base, kind of held a rally in a sense, or it really wasn't a rally like President Trump would hold. It was an opportunity for the president as the commander in chief to come and thank a base that had provided a lot of the planes. In any event, so my office at the time, I worked in the base legal office, was right across the part of the street from the park that you visited this past week. It was very close to the flight line. You can, but in any event, the building I worked in is now long gone. That was 25 years ago that I left. But President Bush spoke at this rally at the park right across from my office. Large crowd. He was very well received. It was quite a memorable event. And then about 6 weeks after that was when the war ended. And we had the first wave of our deployed forces coming back to the base. I'd say the first wave because there were multiple ones. And that included the return of two of our pilots that had been shot down and were POWs. Like you say, Richard, in talking to your son-in-law who's an F-15E pilot, these pilots go up, they fly. The F-15E, when it first came online, it was touted as one of its strengths was that, that it would fly all weather, including night missions, because of its more advanced technology. And so they fly a lot of night training missions to prepare for that combat role. But it's dangerous business. When I was on active duty, my first assignment, Luke Air Force Base, in the space of 6 months, we had three planes go down in training crashes. They were all fatal plane crashes. And even though I was, quote-unquote, just a military lawyer, on each of those, I was part of the what they call the disaster response team that would get in helicopters and fly to wherever the crash was, which for two of those crashes were in the rather barren desert of southwest Arizona. But in any event, yeah, that's it, when you realize that the risk that these folks are taking every day, not just in wartime, but they train. They train hard. They train for what they're going to have to do in war, and it's dangerous, dangerous stuff. So I'm glad you had the opportunity, and
impressed. Quick story before we, they one of the things that they do, and I'm sure people are familiar with this, is when the planes are up in the sky, they get refueled by the tanker. And I asked them, I said, hey, Matt, so how fast are you going when you're refueling? And he said, when you slow down, everyone slows down to about 400 miles an hour. And if anyone's ever seen what this looks like, either on TV or a picture, literally have this jet, the F-15, flying up underneath the tanker at 400 miles an hour, again, slowing down to 400 miles an hour. And then the boom comes out to fuel the jet. And as he said to me, he said, it's like connecting two Dixie cups together, going at 400 miles an hour, thousands of feet up in the air. I got to tell you, I was like, you got to be kidding me.
I had the opportunity when I was stationed at Seymour. Back then, they had KC-10 refuelers. Now I think they have KC. They went back to the older KC-135s. But I had the opportunity once to fly on one of the KC-10s with a group of some others, and we had the opportunity to sit, to watch some refuelers in progress, and it is pretty amazing. You're up there flying at 10,000, 15,000 feet, whatever the altitude is, and you're cruising along. You're looking out this window, which is facing down towards the ground and back, in the rear of the plane, behind the plane, and you have just a fantastic view of planet Earth below you. And you're cruising along, and then all of a sudden, this fighter plane will fly up just amazingly close to the plane. They've got a hook up, then you fly along as they refuel, and then they finish and they back away, and another plane will then fly up, take its place. So imagine doing that in bad weather or at nighttime and wartime. I mean, it does give you more respect for what all these people do. So in any event, looks like we're running out of time tonight. I wanted to in one final segment before I turn over to Richard for our coaching into care segment, I wanted to make another pitch for a topic we've discussed on many prior shows. That's the important issue that deals with our veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan who are exposed to toxic substances because of these open burn pits. In our September 11, 2017 show, we had an interview with the film director, Greg Lovett. His film documentary on the burn pits issue was entitled Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How American Poisoned Its Soldiers. It's a documentary that focuses on the Iraq and Afghanistan burn pits and how a large number of veterans now suffer very serious health problems due to the numerous toxic substances which were incinerated in those open burn pits. If you want to find out more, go to the Facebook website and the Facebook search engine, type in the words burn pit documentary. That should bring up the website for Greg Lovett's film, Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers. The film has been screened at selected theaters around the country. It's been basically crowdfunded through the website tugg.com. You can check out that website, tugg.com, but also the Facebook page. You can also buy an individual DVD of the film if you're interested, but it's a very important film. It has a purpose. It's not just, gee whiz, isn't that something, but the purpose is to educate people, educate members of Congress, educate the VA about this so that hopefully the rules can be enacted so that veterans don't have to fight the VA for the next 20 years as they suffer from these cancers and other respiratory problems. So it's an important issue. We'll continue to cover it. Over to you, Richard.
Thank you, David. And before we close the show tonight, we'd like to provide you with our weekly reminder to veterans and their families about an important VA program called Coaching into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call, toll-free 1-888-823-7458. The hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, thanks, Richard. It's been another quick hour, hopefully an informative one for our listeners. It's time for us to go. We'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. We'd also like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We'd like to invite listeners to become show guests, sponsors, and advertisers. That's real important because, as Richard has said many times, this show is for veterans. It's not about the two of us as the hosts of the show. It's really, we want to make the show of relevance and of interest to you listeners. So we invite listeners to become show guests. Contact us. If you need our phone number and email, go to our show's website. It's bbsradio.com/TheVeteransNewsHour. You have our emails and phone numbers there. Give us a call. Send us an email if you're interested. If there's anything you'd like to talk about that you think is of interest to veterans and their families. And the other good thing about BBS Radio is you can find archived podcasts of our prior shows going back to when we started in January of 2017. We've had some pretty interesting guests on a wide variety of topics, hopefully very informative, and we're lining up some guests for the next few months. So please stay tuned in future weeks. Same time, same station here on BBS Radio. We'll see you next week for another edition of Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope you have a great week. Good night.
Thank you, David. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.